From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. This week, President Obama twice made good on his promise of greater transparency in the price of war. On Thursday morning, he introduced a $3.5 trillion budget that offered a stricter accounting of the dollars devoted to the fighting on two fronts.
For too long, our budget has not told the whole truth about how precious tax dollars are spent. Large sums have been left off the books, including the true cost of fighting in Iraq and Afghanistan.
Later Thursday afternoon, Secretary of Defense Robert Gates held a press conference at the Pentagon to announce another shift in policy, also aimed at publicizing the cost, not in treasure, but in blood.
First, I would like to make an announcement regarding the department's policy toward media coverage of the return of our fallen heroes at Dover Air Force Base. As you know, the president asked me to review this policy. I have decided that the decision regarding media coverage of the dignified transfer process at Dover should be made by those most directly affected, on an individual basis, by the families of the fallen.
Salon.com's national correspondent Mark Benjamin has repeatedly covered the issue of the media and the returning fallen. He joins us once again. Mark, welcome back.
Thank you for having me, Bob.
Under the second President Bush, the policy prohibiting media coverage of the returning coffins was very strictly enforced. But the policy actually originated well before George W. Bush. Tell me about its origins.
That's correct. The original policy was actually written in 1991 by someone everyone's heard of, Dick Cheney, who at that time was Secretary of Defense. He put that policy in place under the first Bush administration, just on the eve of the first Gulf War, to prevent photographs of those caskets. And it's never been lifted. However, President Clinton many times allowed photographers to go ahead. He basically made exceptions to that ban.
Now, the stated reason, if I recall correctly, for the policy was respect for those who had made the ultimate sacrifice and for their survivors. Is there any evidence that we can take the two Bush administrations' words for that?
They've also said that, you know, families would feel like they needed to travel across the country and be there, and we don't want people to have to feel like they have to do that. I don't think anybody believes it, and I also think it fits in with a whole series of steps that the Bush administration took to try to keep the cost of war hidden. Early in the Bush administration, retired General Tommy Franks coined the term the Dover effect, and what he was referring to was he believed that there was only a certain number of images of flag-draped coffins that the American public was willing to see, willing to put up with, before support for a war begins to fade.
So the current administration is making an abrupt about-face on the policy, although the Secretary of Defense, Robert Gates, was the Secretary of Defense in the latter part of the George W. Bush administration as well. What's the stated reason for the reversal, and what do you make of it?
The stated reason for the reversal is that the Obama administration has made a big deal of government transparency on all levels. And, you know, it's a symbolic thing to a certain extent. I mean, you know, we're only allowing photographers to go in and take pictures of coffins, but I think it's a big deal. I mean, I think people really felt like the Bush administration was hiding the ball on a lot of things, and the cost of war was one very potent example.
Now, we can assume that the president is well motivated in changing this policy for all the reasons that we've spoken of now going back years on this subject. But you can also argue, at least from a political point of view, that this is a very cynical move of the president, spun as transparency, but in effect a way to scare Americans into what many Republicans believe is a premature exit from Iraq. That in effect, Obama is exploiting the Iraq and Afghanistan dead for his own political purposes.
I don't think so. I think President Obama, as you probably know, just dispatched an additional 17,000 troops to Afghanistan. Things in Afghanistan are very bad, and nobody thinks they're going to turn around very quickly. So, you know, it's not like this president is not going to be on a wartime footing for a very long time, and soldiers are going to be coming home with those flags draped over those caskets. So that sort of takes away any motivation I think he would have to scare people out of supporting a war.
We've been assuming for the purposes of this conversation that it is categorically good for the American public to see images like this. But can you explain why exactly it is that the press should photograph these returning coffins and what benefit that confers on the American public?
Well, I just think it's our job to show the truth, the whole story, warts and all. I mean, think about it. When was the last time you saw an image of a dead American in Iraq? The other thing that's happening, and this is part of the big story here, is that the smallest percentage of Americans is serving in the armed services in the history of the country. It's less than 1%. So what we've got is we're not seeing it. We're not seeing the images of these dead bodies. We're not seeing images of coffins. And few of us even know people who have served in Iraq. It's a very, very surreal situation where a small percentage of the country is shouldering an enormous burden. And that's an important story.
All right, Mark. Well, as always, many thanks.
Thanks for having me, Bob. I appreciate it.
Mark Benjamin is national correspondent for Salon.
This week, a court came out in defense, at least for now, of the leak. Here's the backstory. In 2006, a former Pentagon analyst named Lawrence Franklin was sentenced to more than 12 years in prison under the 1917 Espionage Act for leaking classified information to people not authorized to receive it. We don't know the exact nature of the information, just that it had something to do with possible Iranian threats to the U.S. or others. The government also decided to use the Espionage Act in an altogether new way to pursue a case against those who received that classified information, namely former American Israel Public Affairs Committee lobbyists Stephen Rosen and Keith Weissman. Their trial, as of Friday, is tentatively scheduled for May 27th. Now, potentially, the fate of every reporter who has ever received classified information is inextricably tied to that of the AIPAC lobbyists. But they can rest a little bit easier this week because an appeals court made some decisions in favor of the defendants and against the government. The Federation of American Scientists Stephen Aftergood has been following this case for years. When he learned in 2005 that the position of the U.S. attorney prosecuting the case was that people not authorized to receive classified information must resist the urge to acquire it, he was stunned.
And I remember thinking at the time that that can't be right. If the government is engaged in illegal activity or there's corruption, should people close their eyes simply because classified information is involved? If that were the standard, then all of our national security reporters should find a new line of work. But that was the approach the government was pressing.
The reason why we're calling you at this point in the saga is that there were a couple of very significant rulings made just this past week.
A week or so ago, the district court granted a request to permit a gentleman named Bill Leonard to testify for the defense. Bill Leonard used to be the senior most official in the executive branch when it comes to classification policy. He was going to offer an expert judgment on whether the information in question could actually harm the security of the United States, which is one of the elements that the prosecution must prove, and discuss what is considered to be a widespread practice of off-the-record briefings by senior officials to lobbyists and reporters involving classified information.
Opening up the prospect that a parade of high Bush administration officials may find themselves in court, beginning with Condi Rice.
That's exactly right. And in fact, the subpoenas for people like Condoleezza Rice, Doug Feith, Paul Wolfowitz, and others have already been approved.
Now, the decision about Mr. Leonard was made 10 days ago. This week, there were two more decisions, also not very favorable to the government's case.
There was a new opinion issued by the appeals court, which said that the defense can introduce the classified records that it had asked to present at trial. It did something else that is perhaps even more important. The government had been seeking to overturn the lower court's interpretation of the Espionage Act, but they left that interpretation in place.
Now, this was the definition of espionage as interpreted by Judge T.S. Ellis III. You've called this definition groundbreaking. Why?
It is. It's really the heart of this case. And what Judge Ellis said is you have to meet at least four separate conditions. You have to know that the information is tightly held by the government. You have to know that it could be used to harm the United States. You have to know that the person you're giving it to is not authorized to receive it. And you have to know that giving it to them is a crime, and you have to choose to do it anyway. But the prosecution hated that interpretation because it gives them a whole series of things they need to show about the state of mind of the defendants, which is going to be very difficult and I think probably impossible for them to do.
Don't you think this definition may be too narrow, that it actually makes it too difficult to protect the country against espionage by raising the burden of proof so much that it's virtually impossible to prove someone's state of mind when committing it?
I don't think so, no. I mean, I think what Judge Ellis said is that without these proofs of intent on the part of the defendant, the Espionage Act as written would be unconstitutional. Because we not only have a national interest in defending against espionage, we have a fundamental national interest in defending freedom of the press, free expression of opinion, advocacy, the right to petition the government, and so on. And if we took the position that uncleared people have no right to classified information under any circumstances, then we might never learn about questions of torture or warrantless surveillance or unauthorized military actions. I mean, I have to say that I have done what the prosecuting attorney said should not be done. I have knowingly asked questions of government officials about classified programs that I knew to be classified. Should I be indicted? I hope not. But that is the direction that the government argument leads in. And so I think it's important to turn this thing back before it gets much further.
Stephen, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Stephen Aftergood is the director of the Federation of American Scientists Project on Government Secrecy.
Coming up, the anniversary of the day when the great American apple caused a national panic.
This is On the Media from NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. 20 years ago this week, 60 Minutes aired the segment A is for Apple about the danger posed by the chemical Alar. To drive the point home, the piece was illustrated with the image of an apple with skull and crossbones. Alar had been used for decades to make apples ripen all at the same time, but the National Resources Defense Council, which released a report the day after the 60 Minutes broadcast, maintained that it was also a carcinogen. It sparked a nationwide food panic. Meryl Streep testified before Congress about Alar's risk, and the media ran with the story of the beloved American foodstuff that just might kill you. In the aftermath, the EPA ended the use of Alar in the U.S., and apple growers filed a lawsuit against 60 Minutes. And although they lost in that court, they won in the court of public opinion because, as Michael Pollan, author of In Defense of Food and Eater's Manifesto, observes, the Alar scare is remembered today as a case study in media-induced hysteria.
Anytime a question is raised about food safety, it's remember the Alar. The food industry has established this in the public mind as an example of a panic over nothing. I would argue that it's a panic, but over something. This is a version of history. It's a contested version of history. And, you know, I think that we shouldn't simply accept the version that corporate agriculture is putting out there.
Even though they lost their suit, there was a legal legacy left in something called food libel laws.
Well, exactly. This is the other way this has proven to be a boon to the food industry. Fear of similar panics convinced legislators in 13 or 14 states to pass these veggie libel laws. These laws are kind of incredible. They've never had a constitutional test. It's hard to imagine they would survive it. But basically, they hold that if you impugn a food crop and what you say about it damages sales, as happened with the Alar story, or when Oprah was sued by the cattleman for impugning the American hamburger, you can sue for damages. It is easier to get sued for libeling a vegetable or a piece of meat than it is a person. But the industry has been careful not to go after big players like the New York Times, who might actually, you know, press the case. And they did go after Oprah, but of course they lost. Nevertheless, they cost her more than $1 million in legal bills, and I think sent a really chilling message to anyone who would write about food that you had better be careful or you'd better have very deep pockets. You could be sued.
Other than food libel laws, did ALAR have any other impact on the reporting of food and agriculture?
I think it probably made reporters more skeptical of pesticide stories. Even though ALAR was not a pesticide, it fell under that rubric of chemicals applied to our food. The whole area of pesticides and their effect is a very vexed area to write about. It's very hard to prove cause and effect. The epidemiology does suggest that there was some link between the large-scale increase in childhood leukemia beginning in the 50s and 60s and its decline in the 90s after some of the nastiest chemicals were taken out of the food supply. But I think that all this has made journalists a little more careful about wading into this area, for better or worse.
You know, at the time, the industry fought well and it fought hard. And it didn't just have to fight conflicting facts. It also had to battle the imagery of the apple. You know, Adam and Eve, apple a day, Snow White's poisoned apple, children at risk. This was a made-for-media narrative.
Well, apples are very special. I think that that was one of the reasons the story had such legs and people reacted so strongly. But, you know, it called our attention, too, to something very important. Before ALAR, pesticide residue levels were based on adults. You know, in other words, these tolerances that the EPA would establish was based on what an adult could tolerate of these toxins. And after ALAR, it was much better understood that children eat in a very peculiar way. First, they eat more volume per body mass than we do because they're growing. But second, they eat unreasonable amounts of the same thing. So that a child drinking apple juice from a bottle all day is getting a large amount of any residues on that apple, a concentrated amount. So when the pesticide laws were rewritten in 1996, the Food Quality Protection Act, to take account of the way that children actually eat. And that was a very positive development. And I think it really was the ALAR episode that focused attention on that.
So that's the fact of ALAR. What about the message of ALAR? In the last 20 years, it's been fought over in the media, in the court of public opinion, intensive lobbying on both sides. On this, the 20th anniversary, what have we learned?
The writing of history has been done by the victors, who use this to repel so-called scare stories over and over again, and has gotten great mileage by citing it as an example of irrational fear about food. However, it also is part of the narrative of the growth of alternative food in this country. Beginning in 89-90, people looking for alternatives to conventional apples turned to organic. And there is a cover story in Newsweek magazine from this period called Panic for Organic. And there was such demand for organic food that they could not keep it on the shelves. And a whole lot of investment capital moved into organic. Many more organic acres were planted. And you also have that year, Congress, for the first time, passes legislation to establish organic food as an official USDA label and begin supporting organic. So it's the beginning of a whole history of an alternative food chain, nourished over and over again by food scares. So we learned in mad cow disease that we were feeding cattle to cattle. So we learned in E. coli that cow manure ends up in the meat. You know, we learned a little bit about how all those peanut products are made. We get this education through crisis.
Would you say, given what we know about ALAR and all the panics that followed, are we better off with them or without them?
With the panics?
Yeah.
We're better off given no reason to panic.
Yeah,
but
that isn't an option. Not yet, anyway. I mean, they are massively educational.
And that is the upside of a food panic. I mean, look at, you know, mad cow disease in England and here, you know, sickened very few people in England. I think it was 400 or something, and we don't know whether it sickened any people in this country. And many people gave up meat for a period of time, and that was a shock to the industry. And when Oprah said she was never going to eat another cheeseburger, all this led to panics, but it also led to an education. People are forced to pay attention to something that is invisible most of the time. It's a shame that people who did nothing wrong get hurt in these cases. I'm sure there are lots of apple growers who weren't using ALAR and they got hurt. But for better or worse, these episodes do lead to an increase in public education. There has been an attempt since LR to suggest that that was not an education, that that was all about mythology and all about lies. And I don't think that's quite true. I think for better or worse, people did learn something about their food supply through that episode. Even if the reaction was outsized to the health threat, nevertheless, important knowledge was gained.
Michael, thank you very much.
You're welcome, Brooke.
Michael Pollan is author of In Defense of Food, an Eater's Manifesto, and is the Knight Professor of Journalism at UC Berkeley.
Chauncey Bailey was something rare, an American journalist killed as a result of his reporting here in America. Bailey was investigating possible criminal activity at an Oakland, California business called Your Black Muslim Bakery when he was gunned down in broad daylight on August 2, 2007. His murder attracted the attention of Bay Area journalists, erstwhile competitors, who joined forces to form the Chauncey Bailey Project and to continue his investigation. In the course of that work, they helped reveal shady dealings in the Oakland Police Department's handling of Bailey's murder case, which led, at least in part, to the resignation this weekend of Oakland's chief of police. We spoke to Robert Rosenthal, executive editor of the project, as the collaboration was getting off the ground. When we called him this week, he told us that it had become increasingly clear that Bailey's murder wasn't the work of a lone gunman.
The key to the story really was the sense that everybody believed that this was not simply an isolated act. One man was charged very soon after the killing, and he had been a low-level member of the bakery, and it just did not make any sense. So the reporting really started looking at the actual police investigation. And over time, the reporters developed great sourcing, and some of the key breaks were the obtaining of a secretly recorded police video of members of the bakery, including its leader, Yusuf Bey IV, where he is boasting and joking about the killing of Bailey and alludes to being protected by certain police officers.
You discovered, among many other things, that the detective responsible for the investigation had a relationship with Yusuf Bey IV.
We reported that. The Chronicle also reported that at some point. And the police response to that has then been that you develop sources and relationships with people in the community who may be involved in misdeeds, and Bey has been charged with other crimes. But there's no question that there was a relationship that certainly raised from the very outset, I would think, from the police department's perspective, a potential of conflict of interest at the minimum.
Now, one of the ironies of this story is that Chauncey Bailey, while he may be a martyr, was nobody's idea of Bob Woodward. And one of the reasons his story really never made a big splash was that he did not necessarily do a thorough job of reporting it to begin with. Only after his death have, you know, the big guns come in to do the story that he could never quite pull off. Am I being unfair to his memory here?
No. Chauncey Bailey was a longtime Oakland journalist, TV personality, worked for the Oakland Tribune. And at the time of his killing, he was the editor of the Oakland Post, a African-American newspaper. What Chauncey was a great community journalist. In other words, he really knew the community. He wrote stories about the community. He was a personality. People came to him, and he frequently would challenge those in power. And he did annoy a lot of people sometimes by asking very difficult questions. But he does not have a body of work that would reflect a great investigative reporter. To be candid, one of the things that surprised me when Chauncey was murdered was that there wasn't more outreach from other news organizations across the United States. I think part of it would be a couple of things. One, the huge pressure on newsrooms throughout the United States during this period as they downsized, and also the fact that Chauncey was a minority journalist who worked for a minority newspaper, and he was not a high-profile guy nationally.
The reporting cannot have been easy. After all, Bailey was murdered. There were security issues attached to trying to dig into this story of murder and corruption. How did you protect the people who were working on this and their sources?
One of the first discussions we had is that this was dangerous, potentially. Journalists had just been gunned down in broad daylight, targeted and killed. We discussed that, and we basically said if anybody was concerned about their safety, they shouldn't be part of this. We did things like making sure that nobody ever did key or difficult interviews alone. We had phone networks set up where you'd come out of certain interviews, and we'd make sure there was a phone check. We always knew where someone was. So we did take precautions you would not normally take. But thankfully, we've done a very good job, and everybody's in good shape.
So in preparing for this conversation, Robert, I had an idea. What if journalists all around the world, where it is very dangerous to do this kind of inquiry, knew that someone would step in, that institutionally there were a SWAT team where you can file your notes and your sources and scans of documents and so forth to be opened only in the event of your arrest or death, whereupon the resources of organizations exactly like yours could be unleashed so that that death would not be entirely in vain?
I think it's a very good idea. You know, in this country, it's a shock. I mean, there hadn't been a journalist murdered in almost 15 years. There was the famous case of Don Bowles in 1977. But globally, journalists are among the first to be targeted either by corrupt politicians, government forces, police organizations, and criminal gangs because of the work they're doing disclosing the truth.
Well, apart from creating some sort of backup plan for all investigative journalists everywhere, what else has this taught us about collaboration, especially in a world where individual media organizations are shrinking by the day?
It was difficult. It was chaotic. You had competing news organizations, but there was a common goal, which journalists always can aim for, which was a story they wanted to get done. I think now in this day and age, as every newsroom in the country is getting smaller, collaboration is really going to be essential to the future. But it's a new cultural value because journalists tend to really want to hold on to their own story. But I think the end results here have really shown that collaboration can be a very powerful tool.
All right, Robert. Well, all best of luck. Thanks so much.
Thank you very much.
Robert Rosenthal is the executive director for the Center for Investigative Reporting and the executive editor of the Chauncey Bailey Project.
And now for a few of your letters. In response to our story about Kachingle, an online service that seeks to encourage online readers to voluntarily contribute to newspapers and other websites they like, Daniel from D.C. writes that the segment was, quote, too close to a product placement. There have been several attempts at this idea, including Amazon's honor system, but the real issue should be that direct voluntary payments for content is not sustainable.
Scott from Rhode Island disagrees. He writes, I first heard of Kachingle via this interview. Absolutely brilliant idea. It made me want to slap my forehead and say, of course, the first sensible way I've heard of to monetize the online news industry. In response to our story, War of the Worlds, about free speech, xenophobia, and a clash of cultures when it comes to Muslim immigrants in Western society, Raheem Korwa from California wrote to point out a mistake. What I said in the piece was that Palestinian school children are taught that Jews are apes and pigs, and I was wrong about that. While we've read media reports about isolated instances in which that insult has appeared in Saudi textbooks, we could find no evidence of that in Palestinian ones, which I'd have discovered if I'd only bothered to check. My apologies.
But the phrase apes and pigs persists in the popular culture of the Middle East. A simple Google search finds it hundreds of times invoked by radical Muslim clerics as an insult to Jews, documented by groups who monitor those clerics very closely. So we asked Professor Gregory Starrett, an expert on Islamic education and a professor of anthropology at the University of North Carolina at Charlotte, to explain the probable origin of the phrase.
The phrase apes and swine is mentioned once in the Quran. It's in chapter 5, verse 60. It talks about the cost of disobeying God. And what it says is, those who have incurred the curse of God and his wrath, those of whom he transformed into apes and swine. And that can be Christians, it can be Jews, it can be Muslims. There are a couple of other passages in the Quran that talk about apes only. In those two passages, it's reported to the Muslims that God said to the rebellious children of Israel at some point in the past, you've broken the Sabbath and you keep disobeying me, and be as apes, or be apes, despised and rejected. There are many different ways of interpreting this, one of which is literally that God transformed some people some of them the children of Israel, into apes and or apes and swine. But the metaphorical interpretation of this would, of course, be that God is speaking to his disobedient children, and he is telling them, if you're not going to obey my commandments, you might as well be irrational. You might as well lack the kind of reasoning capability that human beings should have. There's a lot of disagreement in the circles of people who interpret these passages. This is a conversation that's been going on, in fact, for hundreds of years in Islamic theology and in Quranic interpretation, and it apparently is still going on today.
Keep your letters and comments and corrections coming to On the Media at WNYC.org.
And post comments on our site at onthemedia.org. Don't forget to tell us where you live and how to pronounce your name.
Coming up, network TV feels boxed in by a new gizmo called Boxy. What would Google do?
This is On the Media from NPR.
On the Media comes from the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, helping NPR advance journalistic excellence in the digital age. The John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. And the Wallace Foundation, where arts and education leaders can learn about how to bring the arts to more people. Downloads at the Knowledge Centre at wallacefoundation.org. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. Whenever we plunge into that ocean of data and chatter, commerce and communion, that is cyberspace, we, most of us anyway, survive and thrive because of Google. Like it or not, on the net, Google is the organizing principle, the unseen hand, the prime mover. You know where I'm going with this. If Google functioned in the real world as it does in the virtual one, it would look an awful lot like God, which is probably why educator and internet evangelist Jeff Jarvis, founder of the blog Buzz Machine, called his new book about how to prosper in the digital space, What Would Google Do? Jeff, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
So obviously the title's a takeoff on the bumper sticker, What Would Jesus Do?, which apparently you hit upon at a conference of anxious media execs, not surprisingly. The implication here is that the same way God is infallible, so is Google.
Well, it's not perfect, Google. Gmail went down last week, but it is the most successful at figuring out this new world. The problem I had with those media executives was that they were trying to shoehorn their old models into a new world, and I, in exasperation, said, no, you should be doing new things. You should be doing what Google does. You should ask, what would Google do? And ding, book title.
You know, I really liked your book because it creates a manual for living digitally, and it's centered on, I counted, about 36 basic principles. Among them, do what you do best and link to the rest, make mistakes well, and free is a business model. That's just some of them. They're all small pieces of a big idea, so give that up.
I think the idea is to try to figure out what Google's worldview is. And out of that worldview comes their success, and out of that comes lessons for us. For example, I think we'll see that companies can no longer build as they did in the past by making huge acquisitions and controlling a whole bunch of stuff. Google did not become the fastest growing company in the history of the world, according to the Times of London, that way. Google instead built platforms and networks upon which others succeed. Google also makes mistakes well. It puts out every product as a beta, which is its way of saying, this product is incomplete and unfinished and imperfect, so help us finish it. Tell us what it ought to be. And that's a very transparent way for a company that isn't always transparent, but Google in that way opens up its process, as I think not only media but other industries should do.
You do give some examples about how thinking googly could be applied to ailing industries, even the car industry. Why don't you give us that one?
I think that if car companies could open up their design process, their sacred secrets, and let us in, they would make better cars we'd actually buy rather than leaving them on the lot, which is where they are today. If years ago they'd had this open process, I would have been one among many who would have said, would you please put a 39-cent plug in the radio so I can plug in my iPod or at the time my Walkman? But they had no means to listen to us. So they thought that secrecy and control was their special sauce. Wrong. It made them deaf. Now, imagine, go to the next step, and imagine that if a car could be delivered to me unfinished. Now, I want it to be safe, but maybe it's unpainted. And I could take it to my student last semester who was a graffiti artist, and he could paint that car and make it mine, make it like no other in the world. Wouldn't that be great? And if I could pick my own seats and my own dash and my own everything, I would have my car, not their car. And a car company could be a platform for that. Now, go the next step. I asked Fred Wilson, the venture capitalist in town, what a googly car company looks like. And he said it's actually already exists. It's Zipcar.
For those who don't know what Zipcar is, will you explain it?
It's more like a club where you can basically pick up a car all around town and just use it for a few hours and drop it off again. Now, the irony of this is Zipcar causes people to buy fewer cars. And you think that's an insane strategy for Detroit. But that's a question of asking what business you're really in. And maybe Detroit shouldn't be in the business of manufacturing. Maybe they're in the business of transportation, getting us from place A to place B. Maybe they could use things differently. It all sounds a little bit insane, but this is the time when we've got to ask what we are in different ways.
It is a little bit insane. Even if Zipcar were our principal mode of car transportation, it still would employ fewer people than those who are in Detroit. Thinking googly can't save the car industry.
Yes, some portions of the car industry and the newspaper industry and retail will be smaller. Well, we're in a small as a new big networked era when Google enables millions of new companies to start. Each one is smaller, but in aggregate, they're much bigger.
So small is the new big is another one of the lessons for life online that you offer in What Would Google Do? And what you're saying is maybe the net effect is just as many people employed in just many, many more smaller businesses?
Yes. I think that in news, for example, you're not going to find anymore, you can't, one company that's going to control all the news in town and own it all. It's just not going to be. So what they have to do is look at it differently and say maybe there is a core organization that helps organize the news and organize the people in a larger network. Some of them may be former journalists who are now starting their own blogs because they're unemployed, or it may be people who volunteered. The role of the news organization changes radically. It becomes aggregator and curator and educator and ad sales organization and promoter, but it doesn't own and control everything anymore. Now, I think when you have this kind of network, news could be much bigger than it ever was. Each individual component, each company will be much smaller. But in whole, I think that news can grow and expand.
If you're going to start talking about how to monetize the journalism business, let's insert our new jingle.
Present and future business models for monetizing the newspaper industry.
I could sing bass, by the way.
Let's talk about what you said about the media industry in your book. Make it free. Focus on advertising. Those have been tried. So far, they can't support the singularly expensive work of investigative reporting, local reporting. I understand, I do, that journalists can make good use of the labor and goodwill and the wisdom of the communities that they create to do research, to crowdsource. But that won't help the journalist cultivating sources in the intelligence community about government wiretapping or poring over classified documents about secret prisons. Or do you think it does?
I think the mistake is to think that news comes from a company. It's going to come from an ecosystem. And in that ecosystem, there'll be many kinds of players. So I imagine something like ProPublica, the foundation-supported journalistic organization, may exist nationally and in lots of cities. I imagine that the Washington Post will continue to investigate and the New York Times will. But I also imagine there are individuals who can make a business of it on their own. And journalism will be supported in many ways. It'll be supported by advertising. It'll be supported by foundations and public donations, not very largely, but that will take a slice of a new pie. It'll be supported by volunteers who just believe in doing this and helping out. In the end, you have a new ecosystem of news that looks very different, but I believe really could be bigger.
But ultimately, this will all boil down to advertisers getting on board and paying a sufficient amount for the individual click-throughs that come to various links.
That is the big question. Will the advertising be there? Is there sufficient advertising there? Is it the present model of advertising or something wholly new? It's not the only value. The other value you can get online is data, is knowledge. Amazon goes to the trouble of moving atoms around and selling us books. But it's the company that knows more about what we buy than any other company on earth, and that makes it more efficient in what it sells. So that for Amazon, sending books around is the price of becoming very smart, and the data is what's valuable, the knowledge.
Google's motto is don't be evil. And that's also the advice you give to the people who read your book. And aside from what we both agree is a lapse of judgment in acceding to censorship in China, mostly Google is not evil. But it could be, Jeff.
The don't be evil slogan could be the height of hubris. You know, we're the virtuous company. But instead, the founders have said that the reason that exists is to give license to employees to sit in a meeting and say, should we do that? Is that googly? Isn't that evil? Now imagine, Brooke, if don't be evil had been etched in granite over the doors of Wall Street and insurance companies. If just a few more people had been empowered to say, should we really be selling toxic assets? Isn't that evil? I know this is awfully optimistic to say, but I have to believe that a company that gives its employees the license to question its actions based on its mission is a good company.
Jeff, thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Brooke.
Jeff Jarvis teaches at the City University of New York Graduate School of Journalism, operates the blog Buzz Machine, and is author of What Would Google Do?
Earlier this year, a free program called Boxy made a splash at the Consumer Electronics Show. Boxy software, still in development, aggregates all the streaming video on the web and any video on your computer's hard drive into convenient one-stop access on your computer. Using Boxy and your computer's remote control, you can flip through movies from your Netflix queue, videos from YouTube, and, at least until recently, entire TV shows through Hulu, an online video site that offers programming from NBC, Fox, and elsewhere. Boxy isn't a box that connects your computer to your TV, yet, though that's on the way, but already with a cable or two, you can connect your Boxy-equipped computer to the TV. In other words, the long-awaited link from the lean-forward experience of computing to the lean-back world of the couch potato. Paul Smolera, who writes for Slate's economic website, The Big Money, says Boxy so threatens the network's monopoly on your sofa that NBC and Fox, the owners of Hulu, told Boxy they could no longer offer their videos.
The fact that Boxy connects to the television set, it's taking that video that was only intended to be on the computer monitor, and it's making it, you know, come out on the TV screen. That puts Hulu in direct competition with the cable companies, which are obviously the other main source of revenue for networks like NBC and Fox.
For a cable company, it's kind of like being shot with your own gun. You've spent 50 years stringing coax all around the country, but you're now selling not just cable programming to consumers, you're also selling broadband coming in through the same cable. And your consumers are using their broadband service to make their really expensive TV service completely unnecessary.
That's exactly right. It's bringing programming, especially in the case of Hulu, that cable has paid good money to the networks for the right to provide. And it's doing so in a way that robs them of advertising, robs them of, with some early Boxy users, the need to have cable at all.
On their side, the cable and satellite providers are kind of trying to move in the other direction to make some of their programming available online. Can you tell me about those attempts and what they bode for all of us?
Sure. And the biggest one, I think the most interesting one, is from Comcast, which is the biggest cable company in the United States. They're working on a program that's called Comcast On Demand Online. The idea is that it's going to be a website where Comcast cable subscribers will be able to go and get to all or nearly all of the content that they normally have on their TVs and watch on their computer at their leisure. The thing that doesn't make it competitive with things like Boxy is that it's only going to be for Comcast subscribers. And there's a question of relevance. Will cable subscribers really want to have all that stuff online? And more importantly, will having that content online keep users who might have switched away from cable from doing so?
As we see companies like NBC Universal and its partner Hulu and presumably Comcast and the other cable companies fighting Boxy and its technology, is that a fight that even in the medium term that they can win? If there's a better mousetrap, won't the world beat its path to the door?
I think so. And I think one of the things that Boxy is doing to stay relevant in that fight is that their plans are to put their program on a set-top box that they're going to sell in stores that will be a direct competitor with the cable box. They're not flouting the law with the way that they're providing the content. They're providing it in a way that cable companies and the networks aren't really fond of. But so far, it's not as if there's a legal merit where they can have Boxy shut down the way Napster was shut down several years ago.
I want to pull back for a moment and talk about convergence, the notion that what is on our laptop and maybe on our mobile phone is also on our TVs, and it's all seamless and intuitive and a natural part of our viewing lives. Where are we in that quest for the convergence holy grail?
Convergence is happening. Boxy's brought all the computer content onto the TV. I think there's a natural human tendency that, you know, why should I have to go from one device to the other depending on what type of individual piece of content I want? Why can't they just all be on the biggest screen in my house when I'm in my house?
So, Paul, I got a very simple question for you. I know you can handle it.
Okay.
What's going to happen?
I need a second to gather myself for that one. I think we're going to see a Boxy box pretty soon, maybe by the end of 2010. TV manufacturers, I should say, are also putting internet onto their TVs in forms of little widgets like weather, traffic, Netflix on demand. So they're not naive to the fact that internet on TV is something that consumers are going to increasingly demand. Also, laptop makers, I think, aren't going to be naive to that fact either. They have the capability to make $300 laptops that can show internet video on TVs. And I think you're going to see cable and the networks do what big media always seems to do, which is to try to protect their interests and take these new developments in technology and apply them in a way that makes business sense for them.
Paul, thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks very much, Bob. It was a pleasure.
Paul Smolera is a freelance journalist whose piece, Throwing Voodoo at Hulu, can be found at The Big Money, the online economic site of Slate. What does 11:30 p.m. mean? Well, obviously that depends. But if I asked, what does 11:30 on NBC mean?
It's The Tonight Show with Jay Leno.
For the past 54 years, with Steve Allen, Ernie Kovacs, Jack Parr, Johnny Carson, and Jay Leno, after the local evening news on NBC has always meant entertainment, celebrities, and satire by monologue, leading us gently from tonight till the wee hours of tomorrow.
See, the Oscars are kind of a special time in Hollywood. It's a time when celebrities take a break from worshiping Barack Obama and take some time to worship themselves. Yeah.
11:30 has always been a little naughtier than prime time and more political than prime time. It's also had a much smaller audience than prime time, yet with enough millions of viewers to be not just a media institution, but part of the national conversation. Even against the various competition from Dick Cavett, Joey Bishop, Arsenio Hall, briefly Alan Thicke, even more briefly Chevy Chase, and the great David Letterman, The Tonight Show has maintained its primacy. And now, soon, the next generation. On June 1st, Conan O'Brien will move from his 12:30 late-night slot and replace Jay Leno on NBC at 11:30. But to repeat the question, what does that mean? The answer is not what it used to. Leno is simply moving from 11:30 to 10 p.m., prime time, where he will not only siphon off audience from 11:30, but change the dynamic of late-night talk altogether. Conan may be superb, but he will also be oddly subordinate, all because network broadcasting is in deep trouble, and NBC the deepest of all. This little switcheroo enables the network both to keep Leno from defecting to ABC and to run more relatively cheap programming on prime time. This isn't about the ascension of the heir to the throne. It's about the last days of a kingdom. In more ways than one, 11:30 on NBC falls in network TV's final hour.
And now, ladies and gentlemen, he. Johnny!
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Jamie York, Mike Volo, Mark Phillips, Nazneen Rafsanjani, Michael Bernstein, and PJ Vogt, and edited by Brooke. We had technical direction from Jennifer Munson and more engineering help from Zach Marsh. Our webmaster is Amy Pearl.
Catcher Rogers is our senior producer and John Keefe our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. This is On the Media from WNYC. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Hi-yo!
Support for On the Media comes from the Ford Foundation, the Jane Marcher Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Geoffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at The New Yorker. So join us every week on The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.